Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this first lecture of the course Functional Data Structures with Isabel Hall. And there is a web page for this course, and you can find the web page through the TUM online page, and I strongly recommend that you go there and look at the web page and read the information on it. I don't want to repeat it here, and you can all read. One important point I will mention. So, So a brief introduction, basically to the background of this course. So it's a course on functional data structures in functional languages, but it's also a course about how to perform proofs on these. So, one could say half the course is data structures and algorithms for functional languages, but for us the code will not be enough, so the other half will be also proofs about these data structures and algorithms. And not just proofs on pieces of paper, but proofs with the help of the machine, and that means we're using something called proof assistant that requires you to write your proofs in sufficient detail that the machine can actually check that they are correct. And this is an integral part of the course. And what is a proof assistant? Well, roughly speaking, you should think of it as an editor where you write text, but very, very formalized text, and you give the structure of the proof, that's the ideal, and the machine fills in the detail, but it turns out in practice you will have to fill in a lot of the detail as well. But what the proof assistant certainly does is it will check that each step that you make is really logically correct, and if it can't check that, I mean, if it fails to see that you can get from A to B, then you'll have to fill in more detail. And there's a government health warning that comes with the use of these systems. It is time-consuming, so you'll find that out. And also, it's potentially addictive, meaning you'll either love it or you'll hate it. You'll find out over time which path you belong to. And finally, it does undermine, to a certain extent, your naive intuitions, because you will find so frequently that you make some claim and then when you're asked to check the details of it, no, it wasn't quite right and there was something missing and I left out the plus one and whatever. So that is really an integral part of the course, to learn how to use this proof assistant. And so I will use the terminology formal as synonymous with machine checked, and when I talk about verification, then I mean that you perform, you've done a formal correctness proof. And these things aren't toys, so I'll just briefly mention two landmark verifications that have been carried out with these systems, with two different systems. One is a C compiler, and that was is competitive with GCC on optimization level one. And that was done by Xavier Leroy at INRIA Paris using the Coq proof assistant. So that's another proof assistant. And we will be using one that was used here in this operating system, microkernel verification, by Gavin Klein, a former PhD student of TUM. And he took this technology to Sydney, and they there he collaborated with an operating systems group, and they verified an operating systems kernel. So these things aren't jokes. They can do real, real hard proofs. Overview of the course. The course will, in the first 5 weeks, roughly, give or take a week, will be an introduction to the proof assistant, with, towards the end of those 5 weeks, already using algorithm verification examples. And the rest of the semesters will be concerned with search trees, sorting, priority queues, and similar data structures, and also their complexity, in particular towards the end, the amortized complexity of certain interesting data structures. And what I expect from you is that you have already had a course in functional programming. You don't have to be a super functional programmer, but you have to understand the technique. You have to have written functional programs. The difficulty here will not be that you have to write hundreds of lines. The difficulty here will be they'll be quite short but very intricate programs. And I do expect the first course on algorithms and data structures, that a search tree is not a novelty for you. And finally, also a course in discrete math that you are familiar with the usual proof techniques, logical reasoning, induction, and similar stuff. So none of this is really advanced, but the combination is what why it's not so trivial. And very important, you will need to do the homework if you want to really pass this course successfully. Part of the reason is that, I'll say this very clearly now, 40% of your final grade is determined by the homework. So the homework is graded and is added up, and 40% of your mark is determined by the homework. And that's it. So, any questions so far? And if they're on the home page, I'll point you there. Right, well then, I suggest we jump right in, because the first thing you need to understand how to use this proof assistant. And it's a kind of a combined proof assistant and programming environment. So, how do you program and prove things in that assistant? That will be our introductory lecture today. And we will be concerned totally with an overview of the system and some initial examples. I think we'll skip that. So please remember, if you see this, then it's parenthesized like that. And also remember that logically this is equivalent to A and B arrow C. So this is just another notation for the same thing. You can do the truth tables and you'll see that this thing is the same as that. And similarly for other arrows that we'll find in the course, they also always associate to the right. And I will use yet another notation, this inference rule notation, and that inference rule notation that if you can prove A1 to AN, then in one more step you can prove B. That is just a graphical two-dimensional notation for this implication here. So there's nothing special about it. Right, now we can actually get down to business. So what is HOL? So HOL stands for higher order logic, and I like to introduce it as a combination of functional programming and logic. So what does that mean? It means that this higher order logic has data types in it, like you're used to from functional programming. It has recursive functions in it, and it also has the logical operators in it. So it has things in it that you will not find in a programming language, namely, for example, quantifiers. And it is a real programming language. And higher order simply means that functions are values too. Functions don't play a special role, except you can't print out functions. But you can still, in the logic, you can compare functions. For example, is one function equal to another function? And the formula language we will gradually introduce, we start out with just, well, of course, a few little basic operators like implication, but our essential important part will be equations for the moment, equations between terms, and of course that's the core of what a functional programming language offers you, equations. And here is a syntactically correct formula. And then later on, we will introduce further operators. So, what are the types and the terms in our system? Very similar to what you find in functional languages. So the types are, well, of course, you can put parentheses around types. And then you have a number of basic types. The ones that we will need are mostly Booleans, natural numbers, integers, and real numbers also. Those are, I think, pretty much all the basic types that you need. And then there are type variables. This quote A is a lexical convention to distinguish the name of a type from the name of a type variable. If you just write A, then the system thinks it's a type. If you write quote A, the system knows it's a type variable. It's a variable ranging over types. So this is a polymorphic type system, like in ML, in Haskell, and other languages. And here the convention is it's a quote in front of the name means I'm a variable. Type variable. And in Haskell, the convention is different. In Haskell, the uppercase letters tell you it's a type. The lowercase letters tell you it's a type variable. I'm not sure about OCaml. I think OCaml probably also uses quotes. Does it? Yes, lovely. Yeah, that's the scheduled interruption after a quarter of an hour. We were lucky. Yes, I think it's coming. Normally, that's the only interruption. A few days ago, it didn't interrupt me for an hour, and then it went away. That was unusual. Normally, it's like 15, 20 minutes. The ABG knows about it, but yes. So these are types. Importantly, of course, the function types, and the function types use this double arrow for certain historical reasons. That's not important. And then we also have pairs. I recommend not to use pairs as long as you can avoid it. So in particular, if you have a function, don't make it a function from A cross B to C, but make it a function from A to B to C. And we have lists, a very important data type, which we'll see more of today. The syntax for type operators is, unless they are specific infix operators, they are written after the type. So this is the type of lists whose elements have type tau. And very much the same, you also have sets over some fixed component type. These are finite lists. These are sets that are potentially infinite. So these are the sets as God made them. And finally, you can define further types as you go along. Then what are the terms? That the basic term syntax is very simple. A term can, of course, be enclosed in parentheses. Then we have just a single identifier, which can be a constant or a variable. And the terminology is here that I will pretty much always talk about constants, that includes functions, but I will just make this distinction between constants and variables, and constants are things that are already defined somewhere, and variables are open things. Then we have function application, one term applied to another, which, as usual in functional programming, is just juxtaposition. And then we have function abstraction, where you can create a new function, an anonymous function, by writing lambda x dot t, and that's the function that takes the argument x and returns the result t. And in other languages, in standard ML, it's written fn x arrow t, I think. I'm not sure about OCaml. What's the OCaml syntax for functions? Oh, it's fun. Okay. And then the same with the arrow?
Yeah.
Okay. And then in Haskell, it would be backslash x arrow t. So they all have slightly different syntaxes, and that's the original one coming from mathematical logic. And then there's lots of syntactic sugar. That is additional operators that people have introduced and have given a special conventional syntactic syntax. I would actually appreciate if people did turn up on time. It's a bit disturbing if you slowly drop in one by one. And what is this? Well, this is simply the lambda calculus. As the core of every functional programming language, you have the lambda calculus, and again, here, our terms are just lambda terms. They're just built up from as combinations of basic elements with applying them to each other or creating functions locally. And, of course, terms must be well-typed, otherwise the system will object to them. And essence of that means simply that the argument of every function call must be of the right type. And the notation that we use is, we're using the Haskell notation for a term has a certain type. So T colon colon R a tau means that T is a well-typed term and has the type tau. And here is this, what you find in parentheses there, the sentence again written as an inference rule that tells you if T has this function type and U has the argument type of that function type, then you're allowed to apply T to U and you get a term of the result type tau 2 here. Now, as in most functional programming languages, Isabel performs type inference, so it computes the types of variables in a term automatically. You don't need to write, annotate the types. Of course, all the constants that you've previously defined, their types is given by the context, but for the variables, you don't necessarily have to give the type. This is called type inference. And there are overloaded functions in the system. Functions that have multiple types, we'll get to that, and then it's not always possible to infer the type uniquely, and so you may have to use a type annotation, and then this is an example. Assume you have two functions f, one which is defined on natural numbers and another that's defined on real numbers, if you write f of x, the system will not know, because x is a variable, it will not know which f you mean, and therefore you would have to annotate the x locally in here and say x is of type nat, and then if you apply f to it, the system will know, oh, of course, it means the function from natural numbers is needed here. And then I repeat what I said earlier, try to avoid pairs in argument positions. So that means this is the way to define, to give the type to a function with multiple arguments. It should have type of an iterated, it should be an iterated error type. I don't recommend this version because then you have to take these pairs apart again, and it's just, it creates a certain minimal overhead that for a novice can already trip the person up. And so please always use this version, which means you define the function as writing f of x, y equals rather than f of some pair equals. And then, as I warned you, there's lots of predefined syntactic sugar, infix operators like plus and minus and times, and you'll see what the hash and the append sign mean, and so we'll just have to get used to those over time. And then there's also something called mixfix, so operators that take arguments not just to the left and to the right, but in the middle also. So the if then else and the case are examples of mixfix syntax, where you have here you have three arguments, and here the case of, then of course you have as many arguments as you have cases. So all of that is there, as you're used to from a programming language. And the one thing I was point out here, because it's something that is easy to forget if you don't, if you're not a frequent user. The prefix application, so if you just write the function in front of its argument, binds more strongly than the infix of the application. So if you look at this term here on the left, you have this prefix application that binds very strongly. So those two belong together, and the infix application is weaker, and so this thing here is equal to this, but is not equal to that here. So if you meant this one, then you have to put in the parentheses. And that's something, that's just a standard convention, but if you have this mixture of prefix and infix, then you may get tripped up if you've forgotten that. And now this is specific to our parser. If and case should be enclosed in parentheses. So then it has the advantage that you do see where the else ends, and that's the parsing reason. Otherwise, it's never quite clear how far does the if and else extend. Here you put in the parentheses, and then everything is, the scope is clear. Right, so this was the nitty-gritty, the small, the types and the terms, and now we go to the larger level. The module system, or as they are called here, theories, because we're dealing with mathematical objects, and the theory is just, think of it as an Isabel module, and the syntax is the theory always starts with theory and then its name, and then you have to import other theories. And then between begin and end, you'll have a sequence of definitions, theorems, and proofs. And this is, of course, where the all the fun happens. And the name of the theory must actually be the same as the name of the file, except the file also has this suffix .thy already let you infer that it's an Isabel theory, and this name and this must be the same. And the theories that you import, the import is transitive, so anything they import also gets imported, so you usually get quite a lot of stuff there. And to make things easier, there's a theory called main that's already predefined, and that contains most of the time anything that you'll need. If we have specific additional theories that you should import, we will say so, but otherwise just start with main, and that has things like lists and sets and numbers and logic in it. Now there's a final caveat concerning concrete syntax. In the theory files, the larger objects, types, terms, and formulas need to be enclosed in double quotes. That's for parsing reasons, and we will see that in the examples very early on. I will, after a couple of weeks, I will drop on the slides these double quotes because they get in the way of reading things, but in the files you'll have to have them. And unless it's a single identifier somewhere, then you can don't need any quotes around it. Actually, not shown on slides, so not after a couple of weeks. I think I drop it right away. Yeah. So how do we interact with the system? Through an interface, and the interface is a customized version of the JEdit editor, and you really start the system with Isabel, and then you give it the command JEdit, and then the theory. And what is Isabel JEdit? It's based on this JEdit editor. It's a Java editor, and it processes the Isabel text that you type in right away when you type it, and so you don't need to press any input button. It's just like any modern programming language IDE. As soon as you type, the system starts processing it. And I think rather than talk about it, I should rather show you how the system works.
Nope, that's not it. Where are we? Is that it?
Yes, that's it. Right. So this is already, I've already opened the system on a on a theory called, as you can see, overview demo.theory. You can get all the material, including the slides and including these demo files, from, I think it's a Bitbucket repository, and from the homepage of the course, there's a link to the Bitbucket repository, and you can download and update things. So I think the demo files are all in place, and for the first couple of weeks, the slides are also there, but after that, there are certain... not everything is fixed yet, and so the slides will come incrementally, but with the repository, you can just update and get the latest version all the time. So what does this theory look like? Well, it starts the way that I told you. Theory name imports, in this case, main, and then a begin, and finally at the end, an end. Here's a simple comment, and here are more... more sophisticated comments where you can generate nice LaTeX from, but that's not, for our purposes, not worth the trouble. So let's focus here on what comes below. So the commands, so these are all in blue, they're all commands that you give to the system, and then they typically have arguments, like the term command is simply a diagnostic command that says to the system, please read this term and tell me what you think about it. Mm-hmm. And if you then click on that line and you also open the output window, there's somewhere there's a bar like here where you can, I hate this. Because you should be able to... Ah, there. Yes. Right. So here you can, in the upper window, that's your input window, and in the lower window, that's the output pane, and the system tells you what its reaction to your command was. So here you put in term true, and the system tells you or echoes true, and also tells you what the type is that it inferred for the constant. And here you can already see the system has two predefined constants, true and false, of type bool, with capital letters. And if you forget that true and false are capitalized and you type in true like this, then you immediately get a color feedback because now it's in blue rather than in black. And the system, anything that it will, any identifier in blue means it's a variable. And why is it a variable? Because the system has never seen the identifier true with lowercase. And so what will it make of it? It'll say it's a variable. That's why it's blue, and it has type A down here, and so it's a type variable because the system couldn't figure out what the type is. There is no fixed type for this thing in the system, so it just gets a polymorphic type. So that is a clear indication that this is not what you meant, unless you really wanted to use a variable called true. And then you can write down more complicated terms, like this next one, true and false, and you can see that there are... ASCII equivalents of these nice symbols, and you can type in the ASCII equivalent, the ampersand, and the system will echo it in the nice logical conjunction symbol. And it'll also figure out that this one is bool, of course. How about the next one?
what should the type of the next term be? Pardon? Who thinks it's a variable? What's the alternative? Boolean. Right. And in this case, it has to be a Boolean because there's an and in it. And so it'll the false is a variable, but the whole term is a Boolean because that's the only thing you can do with an and. The and has to be a Boolean. And now it actually forces the false to be a variable. The false stays a variable because it's not a known symbol, but the type of false will no longer be A, but it will now be bool. And how do I find that out? I can hover over that symbol and on my Mac press the command key and start hovering, and then, yes, something pops up, and it says this is a free variable of type bool. And it has to be of type bool because otherwise it wouldn't be allowed as an argument to the AND symbol. So, in case you're wondering what's going on in your formula, you may want to just hover over individual symbols, and the system will tell you what that symbol is. So if you hover over the true, it'll tell you this is a constant of type bool. And if you hover over the and, it'll say it's a constant of this name. I don't know why it's not showing you the type now. But what you can actually do is you can also then, let's do this hovering, and then click on it, and it should take you to the definition. So there is a definition of the system, which in this case is not very readable because there's some interesting logical background material that you need to understand. But true is a defined symbol in the logic. And with any symbol, you can always hover and click to be taken to the place of definition. Now, this was not so interesting. You just ask the system to echo a term. Now you can also evaluate a term. If you write value, then the system will try to evaluate the term, and in this case, true and false evaluated to false, and if you evaluate true and p, it'll evaluate to p, but there are limits to this. So the system, this contains a variable, and a, not everything is can be evaluated, like a universal quantifier over an infinite set is typically not, you can't evaluate that, the system won't do anything interesting with it. And even if it can in principle evaluate something, if there's a variable in there, it may not give you a very interesting result either. So here it gave you a mildly interesting result that the value of true and p is p, if you were to ask for p and p, I'm not sure that it would actually simplify that to p. No, it just says p and p. So this value command, if it's really something that you can evaluate, like in a functional programming language, it will evaluate it. But if it's more general, if it goes outside of what a functional programming language can do, the system will just try to approximate it and give you a hopefully useful result, but not necessarily useful. And as soon as you have a term with a variable in it, evaluating that term is always a bit dodgy. You can't guarantee that anything useful comes out of it. And here's an example of an overloaded constant, the plus symbol here. That's overloaded. So there are multiple pluses on the multiple different numeric types. And if you just write this line here, term n plus n equals 0, the system will correctly tell you that this is a term of type bool because the equality gives you a boolean. But if you ask what is the type of n, you hover over the n, it says it's a free variable of type a. It couldn't figure out the type. It just gives it a completely polymorphic type. Why? Because there are multiple pluses. And if you meant a specific one, then you should write it as in the line before, in the line below, in this line. And there you have explicitly said n has to be of type nat, the natural numbers. And then all the occurrences of n in that formula will have that type. So if I ask about n on that side, it says a free variable of type nat. So, and here are some
more examples of type inference. So here, for example, the first term, let's just look at that, f of g of x of y. So f has two arguments and g has one argument, and you now ask the system about it. F and g and x are completely unknown to the system so far. So if you now ask, what is this? Well, then it'll just say it's some type C, and then you have to figure out, or the system has figured out, what the types of the individual components are. So f, if you hover over it, it says, yes, it's a function from A to B to C. And then, of course, the overall result type of the term has to be C, as the system correctly computed. And what is the type of y? B. Yeah, and indeed, if we hover over the y, it'll say free variable of type B. So this is just in any functional programming language, except for Lisp, it'll work. The percent sign here, that is just ASCII syntax for the lambda symbol. So you can see it reflected, echoed at the in the lower window. The percent has been turned into a lambda. If you like to type in your symbols really symbolically, you can type backslash lam, and then it'll already suggest that you meant the lambda symbol. And if you click on, if you press the tab character, then it'll also convert it. So it depends on your preference. Here is a pane of symbols, and so, for example, all the Greek symbols are there, and you can click on it, and then you get a Greek symbol, but it's usually simpler to type backslash, and then something that's like LaTeX, typically all the Greek symbols, backslash, and then alpha, beta, whatever. But I recommend not to play around too much with these symbols and just use normal Roman letters. Oops. Right. Okay, so any questions about the things that we saw in this first demo? Yes?
What is the difference between term and variable?
Between what?
Between term and variable in this context. I didn't get it.
A term just is, please parse it and tell me what the type is. Okay. Value is, please evaluate it.
Okay.
Anything else? Yep.
For the lambda function, or for the library, what is that?
If you try to evaluate a lambda, it'll just actually show you usually an underscore, meaning this is not printable. Functions aren't printable. Yep. So value only works on ground terms like numbers, lists, etc. Okay, so let's go back to the slides. There we are. And now we will go by example through the most important types, the Booleans, the natural numbers, and the lists. And those will really be our bread and butter types that turn up all the time. So, Booleans. This is how you can think of the term of the type of Booleans having been defined. So there's a data type command in the system, and that in standard ML, this is called data type. I think in Haskell it's called, I know in Haskell it's just called data, and I think in OCaml it's just called type. So this is a bit confusing, but it means you're defining a recursive or possibly recursive data type by just enumerating all the possible constructors. And here it's not recursive, and there are just two constructors, namely true and false, and you introduce those that new type by telling the system what the possible values of that new type are. And then afterwards, you there are a number of predefined functions that we can make use of, like and or and implication and many more. And they have this curry type, bool to bool to bool, but they are, at least these first three, are infix functions and taking two booleans and returning a boolean. And a formula is simply a term of type bool. So there is no special syntactic distinction between terms and formulas. It's simply that a term is, everything is a term. It's just that if you have a specific type, namely the type of booleans, then we call those terms formulas. And the standard symbol for if and only if is the equality. So if you write equality between two formulas, between two Boolean terms, it doesn't mean that they're syntactically equivalent. It means that they evaluate, they have the same value. And so, for example, this would be a correct equation. A and B equals B and A. And normally you might write an if and only if arrow. You can actually write that arrow, but the standard way of the system to project it back to print it is the equality. Then the second most important type are the natural numbers, and they are now really a recursive type. So what is a natural number? It's either zero or it's the successor of a natural number. So that means what are the possible values? The possible values are, of course, the start value zero, then successor of zero, successor of zero, and so on. So this is logically a very nice way of introducing the natural numbers. Of course, computationally, this is terrible, but there is internally another more efficient representation, so don't worry about that. Just worry about the logical side of things. And so these are the numbers, of course. That's number zero, that represents number one, and so on. And typically, for the small numbers, namely for one, if you have input one, and then during a proof, it will usually happen that the one gets converted to a successor of zero. If you input larger numbers, they stay numerals. They're not converted into the successor notation because it would blow up on you. And then there are many predefined functions, in particular addition and multiplication, on natural numbers. And do remember that all the numeric types rely on overloaded function symbols. So even down to the numbers themselves, if you write 0, 1, or 2, or whatever, it's by default polymorphic. It's not necessarily a natural number, an integer, a real number. You would have to give a type annotation. And similarly, for the plus, by default, the plus is completely polymorphic and could be on any type, in particular on on specific numeric types. So you may have to write 1::nat to make sure that you get the right one. Of course, if you're in the context of something, you write, like you call a function that has already, is defined to have type nat as the argument type, and you call f on 1, then of course that 1 must be must have that argument type. But if none of the context forces a particular type, then you have to sometimes add these annotations. Yes, and so unless the context is unambiguous, here's an example of an unambiguous context. If you write suck of z, then z must be a natural number because there is only, unless you define another one, there's only one successor function, one suck function in the system, and that's the one on natural numbers. But on the other hand, there are multiple pluses, and therefore that one is ambiguous, but that one is unambiguous here. Yes?
Understand that if you type 1 is a natural number, just understand that 1 is exactly the successor of 0?
So, in fact, there is an equality in the system, an equation in the system that says 1 equals sac of 0.
But we are the one who introduced the function successor to the system.
Yeah, yeah, but this is... No, you didn't do this. This is done like 10,000 lines before you even start. So you're importing a gigantic library that has everything in there, including that one, and including the equation that 1 is equal to successor of 0. So you can rely on that. Yes?
What if you have two polymorphic functions, one of overloaded to be NUT and some other type B, and one overloaded to NUT and some type C? Does the system infer that it has to be NUT now? Or if you use both in the same context?
Yes. So I think it does. So if you have an application, not for f of x and g of x, and the f is polymorphic but the g is not, then the x will be forced. So there is as much type inference as is possible. So if you can figure out a specific type, the system will figure out that specific type. And now let's look at the natural numbers. Or rather, this is a demo theory. That is, this is not the real definition of the natural numbers. This is our toy definition of the natural numbers and some demo material. Yes. And if you want to open a new file, then you just go on open and select the file, and then we have NatDemo, and I opened that one. Oh, actually, I don't define the natural numbers. I do use the theory main and do rely on the natural numbers already being predefined, but I define another addition function in this block here. And the addition function takes, as it should, two natural numbers and returns a natural number and is defined by recursion on the first argument. So you'll find that many of the functions that we define are defined by recursion on one of the arguments. Sometimes on two arguments, then it's a bit trickier, but this is a standard definition template. And here you have two cases. If the first argument is 0, then of course we just return the second argument. So you see here this block is the standard way of defining a function. First comes the name of the command called fun. Then comes the name of the function that you're defining. Then comes its type. Then just a keyword where. And then comes a list of equations separated by the vertical bars. And you see here the larger elements, like this type here has to come in double quotes, each equation has to come in double quotes, and then inside you have a single equation. And the first one we just discussed, if the first argument is 0, you return the second argument, because if you add nothing to something, then you get the something back. And here in the second equation, what you do, the first argument is plus 1, so you have m plus 1. That's, one would intuitively think of it, because people don't think in terms of successor. So you have m plus 1, and you want to add it to n. And what you do is you first recursively add m and n, and then you add 1 to it. So this is a terminating function definition, because it just pulls out all the successors from the first argument and eventually gets down to the bottom when the first argument has been exhausted. Then it becomes the second argument, and all the successors of the first argument have been stacked on top of the second one. So this is how you can think of it. And the fun command will actually perform a termination analysis, and it says, I found the termination order, never mind what exactly that means. But if the fun command fails, that means it couldn't prove that your function terminates, and in many cases it's your problem. You've input something that really doesn't terminate. And typically, often it's not just that you've yeah, either it didn't terminate, or you formulated it so complicated that the system could no longer understand that it terminated. So in that case, you have to do something about that. You have to re-express your function somehow. And then comes the first proof. So proofs are proofs of statements, and most of the time we just use the lemma command that says, I want to prove a statement that has a name at 02. What is the statement that we're proving? It's this statement here, that if we add to the first argument 0, we get the first argument back. So this is not part of the definition, and in fact, it doesn't have to be part of the definition. The definition is perfectly fine as it is. But it's a consequence of the definition. And it's a consequence that will be frequently useful, so it's a good idea to prove it. And if you just invoke the lemma command, then it will create in the lower pane a little view on the proof state, and it tells you we're in the middle of a proof, and this is one or more goals, and in this case we just have one goal. You can over time get more proof goals, and in particular for inductions. So down here you always see what is still left to prove. And by default, most of the proof commands will act on your first sub-goal. The first one that you have to prove is the one that's implicitly what all the proof commands refer to. And this is a very simplistic way of proving things. Later on, we will meet a much more interesting proof language. Here, it's like an assembly language. You just have a long sequence of apply commands, and apply commands are part of a proof, and you apply some proof command to the proof state. And so here the proof state is simply has one sub-goal, the one that you're trying to prove. Add of m on 0 is m. And now you apply induction on m to it. And so this is, again, some absolutely standard technique. If you have a recursively defined function, then if you want to prove something about it, then in most cases you will need to use induction. And typically induction on that argument where you perform the recursion on. So here, if you look at it, the recursion is on the first argument in the definition of add, and therefore, if we now want to perform an induction, well, here in this case, it's completely uninteresting because there's only one variable, so that's the only variable we can induct on. And so we now perform induction on M, and that will give us two proof goals. The first one is the base case where the M has been replaced by 0. And the second one is the induction step. And please ignore this this prefix for a moment. I will explain that later. And here is the induction step that you have to prove. And it says, well, you can assume what you're trying to prove. And now you have to prove it for one larger number. So you assume add of m and 0 is m, and now you have to prove add of sac of m and 0 is sac of m. So the thing to the left of the arrow, the induction hypothesis, that's just what you were trying to prove originally, and the thing to the right of the arrow is what you're trying to prove, but with an m plus 1 replaced by with m plus 1 substituted for m. And both of these proofs are very easy. The first one, of course, the first subgoal is just by using the first equation for add. The left-hand side collapses down to 0. And in the second case, it's also very simple, and we'll see the details in a moment. We are very lazy. We just apply the auto command. The auto proof command tries to prove things automatically, and it succeeds in this case, and then it just returns, it just tells you no subgoals. It doesn't inform you about the proof, because the proof is going to be, most of the cases, too detailed for you to ever want to take a look at. And then you just finish that whole proof with done, and then it tells you, you've just now proved a theorem. The system calls it a theorem now. And this is the theorem that you've proved. So it just confirms what you've done, essentially. So any questions about the not the details of the proof, but sort of the global structure of what went on there? Yes?
The fact that apply induction to n gave us two results which concern the specific case where n equals to 0 and n is replaced by its successor n, is it due to the fact that we define the natural number as an initiation which is 0 and the fact that
Yes, a very good question. Where does the induction principle come from that the system used at that point? And the answer is that if you induct on a variable, then the system will look at the type of the variable, and the variable has to be a data type. The type of the variable has to be one of these data types defined by lists of constructors. And in this case, there were two constructors, zero and successor, and therefore the system will take these two. For each constructor, it will create one sub-goal to prove. So it comes directly from the type definition that it's based on. Yeah. And of course, you can't do induction on real numbers because real numbers are not a data type. Yep.
I have a question about the pattern matching. Is it evaluated? Does the order matter, or is it?
Logically, if foremost we are in a logic, and then there is no question of an evaluation order. If you actually export code from it, then it depends which programming language you use, and it'll then. Since we will get to that, the functions have to be all total; they have to terminate everywhere. In that sense, it makes no. Everything will terminate. It may just terminate slower or quicker depending on the evaluation order. Yeah. Because of this assumption of totality, it doesn't really matter into which programming language we export the code, except that in Haskell it might be fast and in OCaml it might be slow. That could happen. Yeah. Because of the lazy evaluation in Haskell. Yeah, so you write it down like this, and logically it's okay, but this is a subtle step when you get to a programming language. Yeah. Then let's get back to the slides. Those were the natural numbers. And this is the informal proof that you should have written in, say, a course on discrete mathematics. And we may initially even require to write an informal proof where the details are exposed. So you want to prove this, proof by induction on M. And then we have two cases. We have the base case, case 0. And there we prove add of 0 and 0 equals 0. And that holds by definition of F. Then we have a case successor. This is the induction step, where we assume the induction hypothesis, add of n and 0 is m, so that's exactly what we're trying to prove. And then we need to show that it also holds for the successor. And how do we do this? Simply by a chain of equations. So let's start here on the left-hand side. This is the full chain. Oh, no, so this is the first step. Add of m and 0. By definition of add, you can pull out the successor from the first argument. That was the second equation for add. And then, of course, this glaringly is the left-hand side of your induction hypothesis. And so this term is equal to this term by induction hypothesis. So I will frequently use this abbreviation. And that's what we need to show. So this was a very simple proof in two steps we got from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. And that's essentially what happened also behind the scenes. the system would have found that proof by just using the definition of this, of the function and using the induction hypothesis in the way that it, they are stated. So there's not much intelligence going on here. It's a really quite a straightforward task. And that's why Auto is good at it. And when it becomes more difficult, you will have to input more details yourself. Now we get to the lists. A very important type. Lists of elements of type A are called A list. And this is how, in fact, it is defined in the system. So it's a recursive data type with that name. And it has two constructors, nil and cons. And nil is just the empty list. And cons is a list that you get by taking an existing list and putting one more element in front of it. So you should think of this as the operation of putting an element in front of the list, of constructing a new list by adding a single element to the front. And so here are some lists. Nil is a list. Cons 1 nil is a list. Think of it as the single element list with the 1 in it. Cons 1, cons 2 nil is a list, and so on. So all the lists are these long chains of conses, always in the first argument some element, and then in the rest the list, and then you end in nil. In the system, there's lots of predefined sugar, in particular for lists. So you don't have to write nil. You can write open bracket, close bracket, and instead of cons x x's, you can write a hash sign, the infix hash sign that separates the head of the list, the first element of the list, from the tail of the list, the rest of the list. So this is standard terminology for lists, talking about head and tail of the list. And if you have longer lists, you can also write them like this. This, if you have fixed elements x1 to xn, then you can write it like that. But this is, again, just an abbreviation for this. So it's a long list of conses with one element after the other, terminating with nil. So this is nice to type, but always remember, internally, it's just an abbreviation for this, and this, in the end, just goes to nil and cons. And the proof principle for lists is similar to the proof principle for natural numbers. You have one base case and one induction step, but the induction step is a bit more complicated because there are also the elements involved. And so this is the proof principle of what is called structural induction for lists, and that is also the default proof principle. If you say induction and then a list variable, the system will set up exactly this proof, these two proof goals. So if you're trying to prove some proposition P that contains some list variable X's, and you want to show that this holds for all lists, then by induction, you have to prove that it holds for the empty list, and you have to prove that if you assume the proposition that you're trying to prove, that it implies the proposition of a list that is one length longer. So you can also think of this as induction on the length of the list, except that it's really, it doesn't allow you to talk about lists of smaller, arbitrarily smaller sizes, but only from a list of size n to a list of size n plus 1. So it just goes down in one step, or goes up in one step, actually. This is the goal that you'll be presented, but what you will find in all good introductions to induction, it will say for arbitrary but fixed x and x's. So that means locally in this induction step, you fix first element x, and you fix some list x's, and for those x and x's, you prove this induction step. So they are really local to your subproof here, and if there's another X in the context somewhere, that will just be shadowed, and this is the one that, your local one is the one that you have to talk about. So you're not allowed to make any assumption by an accidental X in the context, which, for example, you may have the assumption that X is 5, and then you use this induction. You can't then use that X from the context. It's a new X that you get just for that proof step. And this is how, in fact, the system internally stores this proof rule. Remember, the horizontal line is just an abbreviation for a long chain of equations. So if you can prove P is true for the empty list, and you can prove this implication here, that's this one, and you can prove it, and this is what this quantifier here does. This is really a universal quantifier, and it says, well, you have to prove this for arbitrary x and x's that are locally here, and they're not any global x's, and x's are no longer visible. So this is the system's way of introducing a new local name, and please note the quantifier ranges as far as possible over here. So this one, this quantifier binds over the whole implication. And these are the two subgoals that you will see when you perform an induction, the two things on top of the line if you're trying to prove P for some X's. Yep.
So XS would be some list containing values, or types X, right? X, dependent to XS would be one more of that type.
Yes. Yes, so anything that occurs to the left, to the right of this of the hash sign must be a list, and anything that contains to the left must be of the element type of the list. And now I want to close this lecture today with a demo where finally you get to do something. Namely, I will not just show you an existing proof, but we will try and find a proof. And here I do define my own lists to show you just to show you the mechanism. So here is the definition of the lists, as you have seen it on the slide, but without any syntactic sugar. I just really want to deal with the bare bones lists and not get confused by any syntactic sugar that the system may have on top of that. And this term nil, yeah, it just, yes, the term nil is there to show you that that we need the next line, because there are now two lists in the system, and the system will make sure that you don't accidentally think that you're using one list, but you're using the other list, and so the system uses long names, and that leads to terrible long names like listDemo.list.nil, which for this demo you don't want to see, because in this demo we all know we're using our local lists and never mind the global ones. So that's why I added this declare name short. And now we will just see nil if you were to do this again afterwards. And you now say nil, then it just says nil of type list. And of course you have to be aware that it's your own lists and not somebody else's lists. And then we introduce two functions, namely the, well, first that's one after the other, the append function. And that just takes two lists and puts one in front of the other. So how does it work? If the first one is nil, you take the second one. So it's pretty much like an addition, but on lists rather than numbers. And if the first one in the second line, if the first one is a cons, well, then, of course, that head of that cons, that x, must appear at the very beginning of the new list that you're constructing. And that's why we have the cons x here on the right-hand side. And then you recursively have to append these two lists here, the x's and the y's, and that's why you have this recursive call. So that's a simple recursive definition of the append function. And I'm not going to dwell on this at any length, because I do assume that you have seen lists and functional programs before, and then you will have seen some such function. And then there's a second function, that's the reverse function, and it takes the list and just turns the order of elements around. And so if you reverse the empty list, you get the empty list. And what do you do if you reverse a cons? Well, you first reverse the x's, the second, the tail of the list, And then you have to put the x at the very end of that. But we don't have an operator for putting a single element at the end of a list. Instead, we have the append function. But the append function doesn't take individual elements. It takes lists. So you first have to turn that single element into a list of one element. And that's what this cons x nil is. So you now have two lists, the reversed tail and the single element list of x. And now you can append the two, and that should give you the reversed cons x axis. So now the x should have moved to the very end of the list. And if you're not quite sure that this works, you can also try it on some examples, like the next value asks rev of cons true, cons false, nil, and then it gives you back cons false, cons true, nil. So at least for that list, it worked. And the definitions are simple enough that this will also work for lists with variables in it. So if you ask what is the cons, this line here, what is the value of rev of cons of a, b, nil, it gives you back in the bottom cons b, cons a, nil. Because none of the functions up there need to look inside the elements of the list. They just symbolically manipulate the lists and its values. And therefore, we could write A and B, and we would get the correct result out here. But of course, there's a limit to that. So for example, if you were to replace the nil here by x's, then the value would no longer be as pleasant that you get down here. Because then now the evaluation will not be able to make so much progress. But that's anyway, you're lucky if things work with variables in them. And now comes the final theorem that we want to prove, that if you reverse a list twice, then you get back the original list. Rev of x's is x's. And we have already learned that how do we prove a statement about an inductively defined function, a recursively defined function? Well, by induction. And again, there is no question what to do the induction on, because there's only a single variable. So let's do the induction on that, and let's then try auto. So this is the proof template that we already used successfully for the natural numbers. Now here, you can already see it didn't work, because the done here, it's there are squiggly lines below it, and there's this red exclamation mark, and that's the system way of telling you this command did not work. And why did it not work? Because, unfortunately, at the end, there were still sub-goals left over, and we can now look at this. So this is what we're trying to prove. If you look in the lower window, and this needs to be extended a little bit. Where are we? Hang on. Trying to move the... now I did. Right. So, there we are. The base case, the two x's have become nil, have become the empty list, and then there's the induction step where you still have the x's here. Here you have the induction hypothesis, and here you have the version of the theorem that you're trying to prove, where instead of x's you have cons x1 x's. And so here this just tells you you have to prove this for arbitrary but locally fixed x1 and x's. And now the auto command, unfortunately, was unsuccessful. It will be successful on the first subgoal, because that is by definition rev of nil becomes nil, and then rev of nil again becomes nil, and so everything is nil. That's not a problem. The problem is the induction step. And so what the system does after the auto command is an exception. It'll try to do as much as possible on all the subgoals. Here it could solve the first one. It could not solve the second one. It did manipulate the second one a little bit. It simplified it a little bit or rewrote it a little bit, but it didn't manage to prove it. And so now it's typically your task to look at this and figure out what additional information you need, and usually in the form of an additional or maybe one or more additional lemmas that you need to state and prove before you get to the end of this one. So now you should look carefully at this and then should figure out what do I need to prove about these functions that we have here in order to make this proof go through. And so I will give you a little hint. That's just by intuitive pattern matching. We have an induction hypothesis that tells you what happens if we have two refs applied to axes. But here, what we're trying to prove, we also have two refs, but they're not quite applied to axes. The inner one is applied to axes, but the outer one is applied to app and something. So the append of this term and this term. So we can't use the induction hypothesis because these two refs aren't together yet. Maybe this gives you some idea of what you may have to do.
We have to prove how ref and app work together.
Yep, okay. So that's a good suggestion. Let somebody else complete that. What does it mean how they interact? Anybody any idea what we should prove here? Sorry, I will go back to the what kind of interaction of ref and app should we prove? It's an equation. Yes?
Well, we have ref append of lists, and an element is equal to append of the element and ref the list.
That's roughly correct. So let's try this. Ref of app, and now app takes two lists, x's and y's, and that should be equal to what? You don't have to do that. That just, in fact, turns out to complicate matters. It's simpler if you prove this general statement.
It's app of
ref, ys, and ref. Yes. I'm not sure it really becomes more complicated. Maybe it doesn't become more complicated, but one should always strive to prove the most general lemma rather than a too specific lemma, because then it helps you more often. Yep, this is the lemma. Now let's see if we did prove that. So let's just write sorry. Sorry means I abandon the proof now, just believe me. And you can now use this lemma. And there are two ways of using it. One is this is... You always want this to be used, then you can just write, you should always give things a name. So let's call this ref app. And then you can say in parentheses, in square brackets, simp. And that means please always use this rule as a simplification rule from left to right. So whenever in a proof you see a left-hand side, replace it by a right-hand side. More specifically, some of the proof methods will make use of this information, not all of them, but the auto-proof method will make use of this information, and if you now go down, you immediately see the done has succeeded. So this proof did go through after we added this lemma and told the system make it a simp rule. Now, I warn you, don't always make everything a simp rule, because if you do that indiscriminately, then the system can easily get into a loop. During a proof, But this one does make sense. We have decided we always want to pull out the appends and push in the refs. Why not? So there's nothing wrong here. And it did work, and you can go down to the auto step, and it really says no subgoals, exactly what we want. But we have to prove it. So how do we prove it? Suggestions from the audience. Yes, on what? Why?
Because we define the one to be inducted in the first frame.
Yeah. So that's the general heuristic that you should keep in mind. Always try to correlate your inductions with the recursion schema for the function. And now, it's not completely obvious, because you might say, oh, but rev is defined on that argument, so why don't we do an induction on y's? So it's just a heuristic that tells you, well, this part here of the formula suggests it should be an induction on x, and that will also help here, because the rev is also defined by recursion on x's. And so it's kind of the majority vote that tells you it's probably a good idea to do induction on x's. But you can always just try and see, and if you land in a mess, then you think, oh, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. And so it'll now give you two subgoals. Let's not look at them in detail. They are what the list induction will do. And let's just try and prove it by auto. And unfortunately, this time auto could not even prove the base case. So just go back. This is the base case, that rev of app nil y's is the same as app of rev y's rev nil. And auto does something, because auto will be able to remove this. This will become nil. And this one, by definition, becomes y's. So the things do simplify a little bit. But that's the end. The system couldn't continue. So again, there's something we need to know about the functions involved. Yes?
Can you just write this lemma app x and nil equals to x?
Yes. So that's very similar to the addition of the zero to the on the left. So it's now for lists. If the left on the right, if the right list is nil, then the append will just return the left list. So let's prove that beforehand. Lemma. That's app x is nil is x's, and let's give it a name. App nil true, because it's in the second argument. And that's also, this is definitely something you always want as a simplification rule. If you can do that, that's always progress. So make that a simplification rule. And let's first put in the sorry and see what the effect is. And now we go down to the second proof that we were struggling with. And so now we do an induction here. We have these two subgoals. We do auto, and the first subgoal has indeed disappeared, and the second one has become the first one. So what we were trying to prove makes sense. So now let's go back and actually use prove it. So how do we prove this? Well, again, it's pretty clear. We have to do an induction, and x's is the only sensible thing to induct on. So let's just try our template, induction on x's and auto. But this is a coincidence that all the proofs in here look the same. So it's not always the same variable. And that worked. Great. Done. So then we have to go back to this ref app business. Induction on x's. Auto leaves this one subgoal around. And now you have to figure out one more property of the operators involved. Because if you look at the bottom line, or the bottom two lines, they're pretty similar, but they're not identical. So what kind of property would you need here to make them identical? And here it helps if you think of the app as an infix operator, then it becomes clearer why the two things are different. Because then it's even more similar. Yes? Exactly. Because all that's the two lines only differ by the associativity of the append function. Here, what we do in the first line, we first append these two terms and then append that. And here, what we do is we first append to that one, and then we append that to the front. So it's just another order, but another order is the wrong way, because, of course, append is not commutative, but it's another associativity. And so let's prove that. So let's go to the very top. Well, it doesn't matter where you put it, but, well, yeah, actually, I would probably put it after this one. Lemma, call it app asoc. And that says app, and now you have to you have to decide which one you put on which sides. For no particular reason, I make this decision. And then I re-bracket things to the right. App of X's, of app of Y's and Z's. And let's first see if that helps. And now let's say for some reason, no very good reason, but just as a demo, we decide we don't always want to apply associativity. In practice, I think you would want to apply associativity always automatically to always group things to the right. But let's see, let's say we don't do that. And then we now have to use this rule, this name explicitly, the app asoc name. And then when we go down to the auto proof step where we got stuck, we can say explicitly simp add the name. So please add that as a simplification rule in this proof step. That's what we're doing. And now, indeed, we were lucky it worked. So we can replace a sorry by a done. So this proof worked. And this is just a modifier of the auto proof. So the proof method is still auto, but we modify, we say, please also add this equation locally in this proof step as a simplification rule to simplify things from left to right. Okay, so now we do have to do this one. And again, the question is, now we have three variables that we could induct on. So let's take a vote. Who thinks X is a good variable to induct on? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay, 7, yeah, that looks quite good. Who thinks Y is a good variable? No, okay, so it seems a small majority was in favor of the X's, so let's do that. Apply induction on X's. And why does that make sense? Because X's appears a number of times in the recursion. Sometimes it helps if I just do this. No. And if it says no signal, then we're really out of luck, because then it's not a question of... So I'm afraid I will, at this point, just stop the demo. Indeed, we would just have proved associativity of the append function by a single induction on X's, and auto would have terminated that. It would have finished that proof. And let me just come back to this. If you Oh, no, that's silly. It doesn't help to switch from to another. But yeah. So,
let me just give it one more try. But no, it's really.
Okay, so this is the audiovisual system terminated me. I recommend that you look at one more slide on the slides, because there is actually an informal proof of the associativity of append that goes through it in detail. So if you haven't seen those proofs before, do have another look at it. And it's a full slide that shows all the transformation steps and shows how the associativity is proved using induction on the first argument. And that really brings me to the end of today.